Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're going to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be those of Joel Skousen, who's in studio with us here on this balmy evening here in June. And we're going to be talking about, well, what are we going to be talking about this evening, Joel?
Well, we're going to be talking about Hillary Clinton's defeat and the Obama-McCain races that's going to stack up. Before we begin, I want to say what a pleasure it is to finally meet you, Dr. Stan, after all these years that we've been doing interviews together, to be here in studio with the real king of Liberty Radio. It's a real privilege for me to be here.
Well, it's a privilege for us to have you here, Joel. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, with the end of all the Democratic primaries, the U.S. can, well, we thought at least we were going to get a respite from the seemingly endless news coverage of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. It's been hard to believe how much free advertising they get every single day. But in fact, we didn't get a respite. Every day has now been filled with Hillary's reaction, the vice presidential pick, whether or not she'll do it or not. So we're going to discuss that with the World Affairs Brief this week. And, you know, I might say that in terms of the factual presentations, Obama's finally achieved the number of delegates necessary to win the nomination, and Clinton has been forced to admit defeat. She, of course, is noted for her liberal use of foul language, so the last few days may not have been the most pleasant for her staff. I'm sure she's not very happy with how things turned out. She is a woman driven, in my opinion, by visions of feminist power and revenge. She's a person who demands to have power. You know, even the powers that be never wanted her to win the presidency, in my estimation. She would have actually tried to run the government, and globalist kingmakers always prefer a more client puppet leader. Now, this is not to say that she would not have been very useful as an opposition candidate, helping to get John McCain elected. It's my opinion that, you know, this is because the anti-Hillary feelings are very strong in the country. But for some reason or another, they began to promote Obama as an alternative to Hillary very early on. They allowed him to gain a tremendous amount of funding. So there appears to be another agenda which we can discuss tonight, that whose whole purposes remain yet to be discovered. It's my opinion that there's a couple of possibilities here. First of all, there may well be, as I know that you probably agree, Dr. Stan, there's some latent racist feeling in the United States. I'm not sure if the United States is ready, at least white-collar, blue-collar workers, to accept a black president, especially one with such radical leftist and Marxist background. Neither might they have been ready to accept a feminist president of the radical nature of Hillary Clinton. Certainly she had her cheerleading section, and so does Obama, but whether or not it represents the major or majority of people in the nation, I'm not sure.
I don't think so. I think, I hate to say it, but I think there is enough racism that Obama's nomination may well lead to the election of John McCain. Neither one do I care for, but certainly I think that this may be why the powers that be actually funded Obama and allowed him to win, at least the nomination. But I doubt he's going to win the presidency. It's going to be fascinating as this plays out. Well, it looks like we're going to our first break here. So, Joel, you just, don't be bashful. Just keep talking. I'll interrupt you at the right time. But here we go. We'll be back in just a moment with Joel Skousen. All right, Joel, we'll go right ahead because we talked during the breaks. And so make your points and please go ahead.
The key issue to understand or question or discuss here is, what does Obama bring to the table that Hillary did not? First of all, both of them have been made very wealthy by insider trading through the establishment. Hillary Clinton had her $100 million or $100,000 stock trade or commodity trade in one day, and that was only the tip of the iceberg. I found out later on that Vince Foster had helped them set up Swiss bank accounts, secret Swiss bank accounts through Mark Rich, which may have been one of the reasons why he got the pardon that he did. But they've been stashing away an awful lot of money. And the multi-million dollars that she has loaned her campaign, you know, isn't really explainable by his speaking fees. But in any case, these are very wealthy people and have been made wealthy through their association with the establishment. Barack Obama has also had millions of dollars bequeathed to him through insider trading deals. And this is what happens when a person gets the nod from the insiders that, you know, they're going to play ball and they're going to be useful in the political realm. But what Obama brings to the table here is a reputation, first of all, and I don't think it's fully deserved, but a reputation as an anti-war candidate. And this puts him in better juxtaposition to John McCain, who's obviously a very much of a neocon, warmongering candidate. Hillary Clinton, because her position was attacked by Obama vis-a-vis the war, does not make as good an opposition to John McCain in terms of the war, because she did vote to go ahead with that. And she may claim to be anti-war. She may claim to want to change the policies there. But there isn't a clear distinction as there is now. Now, it is my feeling, as I think you agree, Stan, that the powers that be want another president who will engender this knee-jerk patriotic reaction to war in the American people. A presumed conservative, and I don't think for a minute that John McCain's a true conservative, but a presumed conservative is much more capable of doing this than a Democrat. But in this particular situation, we have now an unpopularity rating of the president that is so high, it is possible, because nearly 40 to 50% of the American people are getting to be anti-war, it's very possible that they may find Obama useful as a short-term president, perhaps for 4 years, in order to, and certainly we're going to get an attack on Iran during that period, as I will discuss in another segment here.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. And our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. Joel is just saying that he feels that Obama would be able to come up with the impression that he is anti-war, and perhaps the powers that be will want to have him in there. But, of course, certainly the issue here is, what about an attack on Iran? Is it coming before the election? Is it coming after the election? Everything would suggest there's going to be an attack on Iran. But, of course, if you had an anti-war president like Obama, and then, of course, why there was an incident where Americans were killed, then, of course, Obama would say, well, I don't want to go to war, but Americans have been killed. We're going to have to do something. And it's the old technique, whether the sinking of the Maine or the feigned attack, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin or the sinking of the Lusitania. You always have to have an excuse to get the people to go to war. Go ahead.
What I was, and that's precisely what I was aiming at. Jim Loeb of IPS came out with an excellent piece this week saying that he has contacts within the vice president's office that let him know that, in fact, the vice president has discussed with Israel a key plan which matches what I predicted many months ago. I said that primarily if the U.S. was not able to induce an attack or provoke an attack by Iran on America, as they tried to do with the boats that were swirling around the Navy ships, and they had a foreign person come in and interject on the radio as playing as if they were the Iranian boat commanders going to attack the Americans, trying to get the Americans to attack the Iranian boats. If they're unable to provoke such an incident, that Israel was going to do a preemptive strike with cruise missiles or conventional bombs on the Iranian nuclear facilities, not enough to really hurt them, but to provoke an Iranian response then, and that Cheney was talking to the Israelis about purposely provoking an Iranian response to attack Americans. Once Americans have been attacked, you've got a Pearl Harbor scenario that will induce Americans to come on board and say, well, we don't like these wars of intervention, but they've attacked our troops and we've got to support the troops, and therefore it will engender a tremendous powerful reaction to go after Iran. Now, he feels, the best information says, that they want to, whoever's going to be elected, this attack is being scheduled for after the election. So it won't really reflect the election, but it will be a lame duck George Bush beginning the war, of which Barack Obama or McCain will inherit then. Then both of them are off the hook for having started the war, but they will have to carry on, of course, in the patriotic fervor. And I think nothing could be more effective if Obama is elected in bringing the anti-war crowd over to the position of patriotism, or a false patriotism, because I don't believe this is a truly patriotic war. This is an induced, provocative attack on America that we induced in order to get people involved in war. McCain is capable of bringing the conservatives along. They will be there anyway if the troops are attacked. But only Barack Obama is capable of bringing the anti-war people. So I think the establishment could get some things done with a leftist like Barack Obama in there. He's much more radical than the American public has been led to believe. It's not enough for him to disavow the association with Jeremiah Wright. It's not enough for him to quit the church after the latest fiasco of the invited Catholic rector who spoke and mimicked a lot of people in a political way. But a lot of Americans are buying into this fact that he's disassociated himself and he's more moderate than these other people. But he isn't more moderate. His mother was a communist. He has been a fellow traveler with heads of the Weather Underground. He has had mentors that were Marxists at Harvard University, and he came out of Harvard University as an activist in the fullest sense of the word, as a leftist activist in Chicago. So this man is not in the mainstream by any means whatsoever.
I think it's really very interesting. I subscribe to Political Affairs, which is a theoretical journal of the Communist Party, and recently on the front page they had a picture. It was obviously Obama speaking into a microphone. It was a character's cartoon, but it's obviously it was Obama. And the caption above from this Communist publication, the theoretical journal of the Communist Party, "We're winning. We're winning." So they understand what this is all about, but then that case is into who finances communism here in the United States, and I'm sure Obama has no idea where so much of the funding has come from, but you go back to the study on the great tax-exempt foundations back in 1954, when the Congress was allowed to investigate the great foundations, and who was funding the Communist Party and the Socialist Party in America at that time? Why, the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford. So go right ahead, Joe.
Well, the key question now, of course, is being focused on who they will choose as vice presidents. This is a very important political process because we have two candidates of which no one is very satisfied with in the United States. We're going to have a real toss-up of an election. The conservatives aren't satisfied with John McCain. The Hillary people are not satisfied with Obama. And Obama certainly represents a minority of the Democratic Party, though once again, I think he is capable of welding together at least the anti-war people on the left. In any case, the question has arisen, of course, of whether or not he'll choose Hillary as a vice president. I think it is possible, but only if she views it in her best interest. Hillary is absolutely ruthless about making sure that whatever she does in the political realm has to accrue to her benefit. She will claim, of course, to do it to unify the Democratic Party. She has said that she would consider such an offer. But then again, you know, Hillary truly enjoys being a senator. I'm not sure she would want to play second fiddle to anybody. And certainly a president would be a fool to allow Hillary Clinton to get into the presidency and take charge and become a rogue agent, so to speak, doing her own separate interviews, which is certainly Hillary's tendency. It's very, very doubtful that Hillary's going to want to be a nice, silent girl to the side of President Obama. She's going to want to negotiate for some positions. She's going to want to negotiate the head of certain committees, such as on health care. So this would be a real problem, especially since she would give up her Senate seat as well. But, you know, The Economist magazine made an interesting observation saying Obama will not want to make the offer to Clinton if there's any chance she will actually accept. I think that's a rather interesting. In other words, he's only willing to go along with a bit of face-saving for Clinton, but realizes that as vice president, she would demand a more active role in governance than any president would dare to tolerate. So we can expect a complicated dance between the two in the coming days. She's probably not going to bring to the ticket what it needs. He campaigned on change, where she lived in the White House for 8 years in the 1990s. He rose to prominence partly in his early token opposition to the war, while she voted for the war. And there is a delicate but unavoidable fact that Americans may be skittish about breaking both the color barrier and the sex barrier for president at the same time. Those are good observations that The Economist makes. I think the powers that be are counting on the fact that the nation may not be ready for a woman president, and they certainly may not be ready for a black president with a radical leftist background. I'd like to give a couple of quotes from Obama's book, Dreams of My Father, to show that he actually harbors a fair amount of racist feelings. He said, these are a couple of quotes, "I ceased to advertise my mother's race at the age of 12 or 13, when I began to suspect that by doing so I was ingratiating myself to whites. I found a solace in nursing a pervasive sense of grievance and animosity against my mother's race, which was white." There was something, continuing a quote, "there was something about him that made me very wary," speaking of his father, "a little too sure of himself, maybe, and a little too acting as if he were white," you know, using white as a pejorative here. He also said, "it remained necessary to prove which side you were on, to show your loyalty to the black masses, to strike out and name names. I never emulate white men or brown men whose fates didn't speak to their own. It was into my father's image, the black man, son of Africa, that I'd pack all the attributes I sought in myself." And then he names several mentors. Take note of these. He says, the attributes of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, W.E.B. Du Bois, he was a black activist communist, Nelson Mandela, South African ANC communist leader, Malcolm X, of course, radical black leader, Martin Luther King, who was a serial adulterer, as well as a civil rights leader and a fellow traveler with many communists. So these were the mentors of Obama that he looked to as he was growing up. I think the media has carefully attempted to downplay any of these types of quotes. I think if any Republican candidate had any background association with the Ku Klux Klan or any of the prominent people who had racist tendencies, it would be all over the press. But they're certainly shielding Barack Obama from this.
I agree with you, and obviously, you know, our reality is created by the people who control the media. They never talk about Hillary Clinton and the fact that, you remember, she had brought Jean Houston into the White House to conjure up spirits, Eleanor Roosevelt, Mohandas Gandhi. I mean, that when was the last time any of the major media talked about that? Certainly, would you want somebody in the White House who was involved in spiritualism? Well, of course, that was never mentioned during Hillary's candidacy, as so many other derogatory things about them. So the question is, why are they building up Obama when it's obvious that he is a black racist? There's no question about it. And Sidney is also affiliated with the radical wing of the left of the Communist Party. And certainly they acknowledge that. But the average American doesn't know that. Anybody can subscribe to Political Affairs. You probably have it down at your local library. Or anybody who wants to see that, those front pages, we'll be glad to get it for them. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, the communists are used in this, the conservatives are used in this, the right, the left. We're all simply pawns in a game. We're going to be back in just a moment with with Joel Skousen as we get his analysis from World Affairs Brief, something we look forward to every week. Joel, go right ahead.
Well, we're talking about the potential vice presidential candidates here. The Globe and Mail observed that the person Obama chooses as his running mate will say a great deal about the kind of campaign he intends to run. I think it's more than that, and for the Republicans as well. It's more about the kind of presidency and what the powers that be expect to do during that presidency by the vice president. For the first time in history, we've had a vice president, Dick Cheney, serving as the handler of the president, being the one who essentially manipulates a puppet president who's there to be a figurehead. Normally, this is the national security advisor, Henry Kissinger for Richard Nixon, Brent Scowcroft for the Ford years, and for George Bush the first. Then there was Sandy Berger for Bill Clinton. These are the people who essentially are at their side almost every moment of the day, and they tell them the issues and what positions that they will take. There's a whole staff, of course, to feed them information. But when it came time, you know, we had Zbigniew Brzezinski during the Carter years, and Strobe Talbot, let's see, he was under what administration, Stan? That was...
Well, he was there under the Clinton administration.
That's right. Strobe Talbot was right during the Clinton administration. These people are very powerful. They're all members of the CFR, Trilateral Commission. These are people who are aware of what the real game plan, even though the president may not be aware. But with the beginning of the George Bush administration, it was very clear that the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, at the beginning of his administration, was just a novice. She wasn't, she was kind of like in training, and sure enough, it turned out to be the vice president who was the handler of the president. Here's a vice president who grew to have a staff of over 600 people. This is unheard of in the history of the United States. A normal vice president's staff is no more than 15 to 25 people, and yet there were over 600 people in the office. The vice president had eyes and ears and paid staff employees in every department of government in the executive. This is tremendous power, and it obviously indicates that this was where the real power was being run. Everything that went through the White House West Wing was vetted through the vice president's office, not the president's office. It was an incredible change. So, in general, with a president, the powers that be want to keep around for two terms. They normally pick a weak vice president. For one that they may need to replace in office, they sometimes allow another future leader to become vice president to help him or her gain prestige. Now, that's why I don't think the powers of be will allow Mitt Romney the prize of the vice presidency, even though it would, first of all, do much to sway conservatives to come over to McCain. Mitt Romney is very charismatic. He's got the capability of swaying conservatives. But they don't want any self-financed outsiders like Romney coming to the big dance. Romney keeps trying. It's sad to see him pander to every neocon talking point in his media appearances. It's a desperate attempt to please the establishment and gain favor with the McCain team as he sponsors fundraiser after fundraiser for McCain. What the voters want is relatively irrelevant, of course, to the kingmakers, except when they're trying to placate public unrest. But it doesn't matter if Clinton earned a second-place spot or not by running a strong campaign. The powers that be are looking at the major issues of, one, who can fool the American people best into going along with the globalist agenda, and two, who will be compliant with the globalist CFR advisors chosen for them.
Well, our guest here is Attorney Joel Skousen, and of course Joel is just pointing out that the question is which one of the presidential candidates or vice presidential candidates, of course, will go along with the powers that be, and there's no question. If you are in a position of power, you will do what you are told. As he was pointing out, certainly, George Bush's handler is Dick Cheney, with over 600 people in the vice president's office. Never before have we seen a vice president with this amount of power. Go right ahead, Joel.
I'd like to switch a little bit here to talk about what each of the candidates said at the local APEC conference. This is the American-Israeli Political Action Conference, and it's kind of the loyalty test for high-level officials to make their appearance and to project a pro-Israel point of view. Now, as a Christian, I am fully supportive of Israel as its right to exist and as a God-given mandate to inherit the land of Israel for all times. And yet, I do not let spill over that allegiance to what I believe is a godly destiny to a support of the Israeli government, which I think is just as phony as being a right-wing pro-Israel government as our own government is. These people have a globalist agenda. They've killed their own presidents. They've betrayed their own settlers. They've betrayed their own national security, and they will continue to do so. And yet they continue to tell their own right wing that we're working in your best interest. But every political candidate, Republican or Democrat, will not keep us out of war in the Middle East, and they said as much when they spoke to the APEC conference. McCain, of course, is aggressively in favor of wars and intervention. There's no better place, of course, to promote it at the APEC conference, which is filled with neocon leaders of the Jewish community. But Obama was playing a little bit of a different game, at least the international press thought so. He was essentially championing a little bit of diplomacy. And Justin Raimundo had a fairly good analysis there. He began by saying, "Will Obama stand up to the war party? Don't bet the ranch on it," he said. If you want to know what the future holds, of course, you first of all look at what John McCain said recently at the APEC conference, quote, "Rather than sitting down unconditionally with the Iranian president or supreme leader in the hope that we can talk sense to them, we must create the real-world pressures that will peacefully but decisively change the path that they are on." Well, there's, of course, no anticipation that John McCain will ever use anything peace. That's only thrown in there as an excuse. What he meant was decisively, militarily, change the path that they're on. He says, "I'm proud to have been leader on these issues for years, having co-authored the 1992 Iran-Iraq Arms Non-Proliferation Act. Over a year ago, I proposed applying sanctions to restrict Iran's ability to import refined petroleum products on which it is highly dependent." Now, this idea that McCain is talking about of putting a limitation on Iran's ability to import gasoline is really an act of war. As Raimundo pointed out, he says, "A military blockade that would stop Iran's gasoline imports would put them in a death grip, and also an act of war, precisely what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did to the Japanese in order to provoke them into attacking Pearl Harbor." This is outlined in Robert Stinnett's book, Day of Deceit. I believe you've interviewed Stinnett, is that
correct? Yes, I have, and that's exactly what happened. And if we were to actually embargo gasoline to Iran, that would be an act of war. And it's about time the American people understand that would be the first step towards an open war with Iran. In fact, we're today, for many months, we've been financing our military groups and trying to overthrow the Iranian government in the outlying provinces. We are, for all intents and purposes, at war with Iran. They just haven't told the American people. We're doing everything we can to provoke them into some sort of retaliation.
There was a very interesting article in the Washington Post just discussing that. And he had insider information, apparently, about how much the Iranians and the U.S. have been at war with each other in Iraq itself.
Right. But, of course, the American people really aren't being told the truth. When you have a press that can really conceal the truth from the American people, when we can focus our attention on Britney Spears and Paris Hilton rather than on the life-threatening issues that really threaten the very survival of our nation, it's a little wonder the American people don't have any idea what's going on. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen, but I share his concern of the fact that should we actually take on a position of blockade of Iran, it will be an open act of war. Well, Joel, you're right ahead there.
Well, Obama's position at the AIPAC conference was to promote diplomacy. But he was able to admit, in fact, that diplomacy was only a ploy. The diplomacy would then convince our allies that if we had to take military action, that at least we had tried to talk first. This is essentially the same thing that Condoleezza Rice is doing. It was interesting that Liz Cheney also spoke at the AIPAC conference and gave a very, very anti-Iran attack. And several other administration spokesmen, or at least people related to the vice president, did so as well. Liz Cheney even had the audacity to attack Condoleezza Rice for her weakness in promoting opponent. You know, this must really sting Rice because she's absolutely following the same globalist agenda that the president is following, and that agenda involves talking about diplomacy right now, just like Obama is doing. This placates the anti-war lobby within the United States, makes the president and his administration feel like they are bending over backwards to resolve these things peacefully, when in fact they have no intention of doing so. You know, diplomacy only is a viable alternative when in fact there's good intentions and that there is, and in fact, a position where some compromise is capable and there's some genuine openness there. Neither is the case, I believe, from the administration's point of view. They've already got the arms in place. They're fully planning the attack. They're simply waiting for the excuse, either from a provocation or a preemptive strike by the military or by the Israelis. At any case, Hillary Clinton spoke up last in this conference, and she, of course, blasted the Bush administration for their position in not defending Israel against the attacks or the future attacks by the Iranians.
What is her point? You know, certainly, if Israel were attacked by the Iranians, I would think that America would certainly go to Israel's defense under those circumstances, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, certainly. If there was, what I meant was that Israel would actually do a preemptive strike on the Iranians, not that the Iranians would do one on Israel. She started out, and by the way, she looked rather haggard. This nonstop campaigning for months and months has taken a toll on Hillary, but she assured the Jews that with her trademark and overused claim, let me be very clear, I know that Senator Obama will be a good friend of Israel.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Scott. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel was just talking about Hillary's appearance before AIPAC. This is a Jewish lobby group here in the United States. But before we get back into his interpretation of Hillary's appearance before AIPAC, Joel, I'd like you to tell our listeners about World Affairs Brief, your website, your weekly newsletter. How can people get one if they'd like to?
Thank you. The World Affairs Brief is my weekly news analysis service. There's a modest subscription for it. It's showcased on my website, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. And if people want a sample copy to see if they'd like to subscribe, they can email me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com, and I'll be happy to send one out. Lots of free things on the website. Volunteer researchers put the all of the top stories of the news every day right on the web page so that they're linked to those and you can go to them and read. They're pre-screened so that the ones with the least disinformation are at least put up there for you. Lots of archival information on the right-hand side of the front page where I talk about many of the cover-ups engaged in our government. Studying cover-ups by governments is one of the best ways to understand how people conspire to distort the truth and the media complicity in that to fool the American people into giving up essential liberties in the phony war on terror and other things. I also have information about many of the books that I've written, especially relative to preparedness. Should we not succeed in being able to stop this onslaught against our liberties from what I consider a globalist agenda.
All right, now, what about Hillary when she was back there with AIPAC?
Well, IPS was commenting on this and said, you know, this assertion, which was not included in her prepared remarks, endorsing Obama as a good friend of Israel, appeared designed, of course, to rally Jewish support for Obama's now certainty of candidacy. But she was careful not to refer to him as the future president. During the primary season, Clinton consistently did better among Jewish voters, particularly among older Jews whose participation in the elections is particularly high. So she is perceived as being very, very pro-Israel and helping Israel. Bill Clinton, of course, followed in the path of all the presidents in trying to broker a Palestinian state, which would be a disaster, ultimately, in my opinion, for Israel. It would be, in essence, a internationally recognized a base of operations from which to terrorize Israel continually. And, in fact, they're doing it to this very day. There's no reason to give an independent status with borders, free borders, to a country who is a terrorist state. That does not, by the way, condone, I think, the lack of fairness that the government of Israel has done in playing with the Palestinians. There have been some unfairness on both sides, but clearly the Olmert government is proclaiming that they're defending Jewish interests. They have claimed as a red line, for example, that they will never accept a divided Jerusalem, and yet I happen to know from various sources in Israel, including Barry Chamish, that they've already agreed to negotiate away divided Jerusalem, and so they simply do not tell the truth to the Jewish people. Meanwhile, of course, the administration is ready to sign a secret agreement with Iraq that will set the occupation in stone for many decades in the future. It's very interesting that the Washington Post, an insider publication itself, was able to say, despite opposition from both Iraqi and American people, it shows that this administration doesn't care what we think or the Iraqis think. President Bush appears to be forging ahead on a multi-year security agreement with the Iraqi government that will lock in the occupation status quo for decades to come. A British newspaper reports new details about the ongoing negotiations. Bush wants to retain the use of more than 50 military bases in Iraq after telling Congress he has no intentions of having any permanent bases, and also insists on immunity from Iraqi law for all U.S. troops and contractors, as well as to carry out with a free hand military activity without consulting Baghdad. So much for Iraqi sovereignty, and so much for American sovereignty, because the Bush administration does not intend to submit this agreement to Congress for approval.
In other words, we have an imperial presidency that is not responsible either to the people or to our elected representatives.
You know, the audacity, Dr. Stan, of this government is as shocking as congressional timidity in challenging executive power. I mean, if you and I know about this, if it's right on the front page of the Washington Post, there ought to be screams of horror coming from Congress and threats. But I don't think there's any teeth in the dragon there in Congress. It's just like the few courageous people that have tried to say, if you go to war, you must have a declaration of war from Congress. We refuse to allow you to attack Iran without a declaration of war. And I don't think Congress is doing anything to back that up if the president goes ahead and does that. And, of course, he will have the kind of provocation, I believe, such as attacking American troops, that will allow him to get on the evening news and say, we have an emergency here and I'm using my presidential powers to do these things, and everyone will get behind him in order to support the troops. And so we're destined, I think, to have an Obama versus McCain runoff. And as I said, no one's really enthused about this. But, you know, the anti-McCain factor remains strong even among Republicans to this day. He's the supposed de facto winner. But in the most recent primaries, Ron Paul, of course, is still on the ballot because he has not renounced his campaign. With 100% reporting, Ron Paul took 17% of the vote in South Dakota. He took 14% in New Mexico and over 22% of the vote in Montana versus John McCain, and that's without any campaigning, without any media, and with the media telling everyone, in fact, that John McCain is already the presumed nominee.
In fact, my understanding is in Idaho he took almost 25% of the vote. So
that's correct.
I think it's important people understand that they control the media. They focus our attention on the two candidates because they don't want us to think about a candidate who wants to get out of the war, who wants to cut back on the size of government, who actually believes in the Constitution and feels we should adhere to the Constitution that every elected representative swears to uphold and defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, we've got an awful lot of domestic enemies of the Constitution, both in Congress, in the Senate, and in the White House itself.
And a lot of people, of course, who disregard blatantly their oath to the Constitution. I'm reminded, of course, of Ron Paul's a resolution before the Senate or the House. What was that committee that he was on where they were discussing the resolution on the Iraq war? In any case, it was chaired by none other than Henry Hyde, and Henry Hyde made some very disparaging statements about the Constitution when Ron Paul introduced a resolution that we declare war on Iraq. In other words, I'm going to vote against it, he said, but we should not be going into Iraq without a declaration of war, and so I'm putting that blatantly on the table. And they began to decry this and say, we don't do this anymore, the Constitution's an anachronism. Both Henry Hyde, the Republican chairman, and the Democratic counterpart made disparaging comments about the Constitution. And it's interesting that when Ron Paul went to get tape recordings from the Congressional Taping Office as well as from C-SPAN, both of those independent organizations had edited out those contents. It was very interesting. I was reading in Dr. Stan's excellent library this afternoon a history of C-SPAN, and Mr. Lamb, the CEO of C-SPAN, was bragging about the fact that he has been asked on numerous occasions to edit out certain things from C-SPAN tapes of congressional hearings, and he's claimed that I have never succumbed to any of those things. And yet we have evidence that he, in fact, did succumb on this most important subject. And Ron Paul's comment about this is one, it actually induces one to believe in conspiracy theories when you see this happening. Conspiracy is, in fact, a collusion of two separate entities who should have no contact with one another in government officials or in circles. So this is a real problem. So I'd like to go at this point to talk a little bit about the Iran war and what we're looking at here. President Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel, came out of his one-day meetings with in Washington this week with a pretty smug look on his face, and he announced that the pendulum is closer to a large-scale military operation in Gaza after another Israeli civilian was killed. He also stated blatantly that, and hinted almost, that he had got the green light from the president in terms of attacking Iran. Let me see if I can find that quotation here. He announced privately, of course, that he was happy with the visit to the White House. He says Israel and America are in one mind over the possibility of military intervention against Tehran's nuclear program. Now, he didn't say that that was an actual attack, but you know, since Bush is in favor of that and Olmert is in favor, when they say they're of one mind, that means he's got the go-ahead. One of Olmert's deputy to his party, the Kadima party, Shaul Mofas, actually former defense minister, kept up the pressure on Iran, saying an Israeli attack on Iranian nuclear sites looks inevitable given the apparent failure of diplomatic and economic sanctions on Tehran. Once again, you see the leverage that they used by stating that there are diplomatic failures, and now we have to move to military action. He said, if Iran continues with its program for developing nuclear weapons, we will attack it. Now, no Israeli official has ever said that before. The sanctions are ineffective. Attacking Iran in order to stop its nuclear plans will be unavoidable. This was the most explicit threat yet against Iran from a member of the Olmert government, which, like the Bush administration, has preferred to hint at force as a last resort should the UN security sanctions be deemed to have failed. And, Israel has twice acted by itself to stop its regional enemies developing a nuclear capability in Syria last year and Iraq in the 1980s. So it looks as if there is a tremendous movement ahead, and I'm not sure what the timing is, Dr. Stan, but it certainly appears as if Israel's finally got the go-ahead to do their preemptive nuclear strike, and we're going to see that happen.
Well, if it does happen, it's going to be a frightening thing, because the implications, of course, you start a war, you never know how that war is going to end. And certainly if we or Israel have a preemptive strike on Iran, and then they were to sturdily strike back, as you would anticipate, against the American forces there, certainly stationed in Iraq, if they were to strike back on any of the boats in our fleet out there in the Persian Gulf, or perhaps at some of the oil loading sites in the Persian Gulf, the implications would be frightening, because then, of course, we would escalate the war and you'd just see this thing rising on both sides. Remember, of course, that Iran has very, very close relationships with both Russia and China. Where would all of this end up? And if you study the history of World War I, it started out as a minor clash following the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, and before it was over, 21 million people were dead, and there was no reason for it at all. But when a war starts, you never know how it's going to end, and there's nobody out there in America pointing out the danger of what our government is doing, even considering expanding the war in the Middle East.
You know, I did find this quote here by Jim Loeb about the role that Cheney had in this scenario. He said, there is the Cheney role, which is becoming more prominent. I'm referring not only to Olmert's dinner with Cheney Wednesday night. He met with Cheney even before going to the president, which is very telling, in which the two men, according to their staff, reportedly addressed, quote, operational subjects, in that does tend to talk about operations of an attack on Iran. He said it was Cheney's top Middle East aide, David Wormser, who during the spring of 2007, when the realists were clearly in the driver's seat, was shopping around to his sympathetic think tanks, a scheme from which the vice president's office was later forced to disassociate itself. So here you have member of Vice President Cheney's staff shopping this scenario around to various of the staff within the White House, of which got leaked out. The Vice President's office then said, this didn't belong to us, we didn't start this, but in fact it clearly did. And the scene that they were shopping around to other people in the administration was forcing Bush into war with Iran by getting Israel to launch a cruise missile attack on some Iranian nuclear facilities, and counting on Tehran to retaliate against U.S. forces. There it is in black and white, leaked from the secret papers being circulated by David Wormser.
And that, of course, is what I fear. If that attack occurs, why, certainly there is no telling where it'll end. Go right ahead.
Yes. So he says, well, maybe Wednesday's dinner was not just a courtesy call. The Israelis clearly believe that Cheney is a player in all of this. And, of course, he's more than a player. In my estimation, he's the president's handlers. Jim Loeb also took note of Elizabeth Cheney, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, who during the opening plenary session of the AIPAC conference took every opportunity, he said, to attack the policies of her former boss, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. I don't think there's any love lost between those two right now. Liz was particularly harsh on Rice's pet project, the effort to gain at least a framework peace accord between Israel and the Palestinian Authority before Bush leaves office. arguing that the Annapolis process was a waste of time compared to the importance of dealing with Iran, which she called a zero-sum game. Quote, when we focus on the kind of arrangement Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, we don't have time to focus on Iran, she declared, suggesting as well that Tehran's leadership was not rational and the previous efforts to engage it had also been a waste of time, or worse. Iran needs to be convinced, she said, that if it doesn't heed the Security Council's demands to halt enrichment, they will face military action. We do not have the luxury of time.
Go right ahead. We've got a few seconds here.
Okay. And, of course, we need to make sure that we see Liz Cheney's remarks in the context of the more concerted attack by the hawks on rice, and which have recently done by the Weekly Standard, Stephen Hayes, also the president, the vice president's favorite journalist.
And I think it's important that you understand how they're giving us this sense of urgency. Oh, my goodness, we better do something quickly. You remember, of course, when Colin Powell went before the United Nations talk about those weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein had. We've got to do something. America's in danger. American lives are in danger. We've got to do something. And we did it, and a million people died. And, of course, we're going to do the same thing like deja vu all over again. Go right ahead, Joel.
Now, contrast this with how the administration handles North Korea. Here, North Korea has actually detonated a nuclear weapon. North Korea has hundreds of missiles that they're exporting around the world and that can attack U.S. troops in South Korea and in Japan. And yet we treat North Korea as if we've got all the time in the world. It violates all of their agreements. It is one of the most tyrannical regimes. We have promised them that we will not interfere militarily. We have promised them that we were not seeking regime change to one of the most evil regimes on the face of the earth. I mean, this is just incredible.
But it's even more incredible than that, Joel, is that we are found new excuse to send them more in the way of food. We're sending massive amounts of food. That food is not going to the starving people. It's going to keep the corrupt, communist, brutal regime in power. And until the American people stop their foreign aid, until we stop funding these tyrannical governments in the name of, helping the people. We're not helping the people by preserving those terrible, ruthless, brutal governments. And that's exactly what happens when we give foreign aid to a country like North Korea. We are keeping the North Korean dictator in power.
And we continue to give them oil shipments at the time when oil was short from the United States. And those oil shipments are continuing, even though North Korea has not complied with the six-party talks agreements that they agreed to. Well, that's part and parcel of how we've treated them for years, and my general philosophy states, this is part of my general theory, that some of these nations are being reserved to be trigger events in World War III, and I really believe that North Korea is going to be one of those. And that's why they're treating those. And yet, you have other events like Iran, which is meant to continue to antagonize the world against the United States, and that's why it's on the chopping block right now. Well, switching to another topic, if we've got time, Dr.
Oh, go right ahead, Harry. I'll interrupt you when we get to the end.
Okay. This week we saw another Bilderberger meeting in Chantilly, Virginia, at the Marriott Hotel there, and those Bilderberger watchers who were there met with a very hostile reaction from the American security guards that were there to protect them. It was very interesting to see the American Free Press confront Amy Goodman and Dan Rather at a conference, asking them point blank about Bilderberger, and their responses. Dan Rather feigned ignorance. I watched the video, and he says, I don't know anything about the Bilderbergers. They talked about the fact that they have journalists attending there, and that the media doesn't mention anything about the Bilderberger. There seems to be a collusion there to protect the anonymity and the agenda of the Bilderberger. And he says,
What did Amy Goodman say?
She also feigned ignorance about it.
How could she be ignorant of that? Anyway, we're out of time, Joel. God bless. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you later here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I always enjoy, of course, having Joel on. He was talking about the Bilderbergers, the Bilderberger meetings, which was recently held. Of course, this is where about 140 of the people who really run the world get together, and they talk and come up with their plans and schemes. The Bilderbergers overlaps, of course, with the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, but they are all elitist groups. Well, the most interesting thing about the Bilderbergers, if you've been to William H. Kennedy's website, that's williamhkennedy.com, getting into the background of the pedophilia at the highest levels of the Bilderbergers. In fact, the fact that at one time in Belgium a few years ago, they had a 300,000 man and woman march. In Belgium's little country with only a few million people, they had 300,000 people there marching against the Bilderbergers because of their involvement with the pedophilia ring. And not one word in the American media. It's covered in a book we carry called Satanic Crimes, in a four-tape or four-CD set we have called Satanic Crimes. And certainly you can go to William H. Kennedy's website, williamhkennedy.com, and get much more information about this. Understanding, of course, behind so much of what's going on are the powerful spiritual forces we are always talking about, because, of course, in these forms of sexual perversion, whether it be pedophilia or homosexuality or the other sexual perversions we talk about, are satanic forces. And don't think for one minute that this isn't all part of the spiritual battle that's being waged against the hearts and the minds and the very souls of our people. Well, if you'd like, of course, to get those books, the book I mentioned, Satanic Crimes, the four-tape set, which we recommend, or four-CD set, Satanic Crimes, our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We're entering some very difficult and trying times. We hope that you're making your preparations for this fiscally, financially, spiritually, because the only thing that's going to see any of us through this is our personal relationship with our Lord. And if you don't have a personal relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ and you'd like more information, why, you can always give us a call off the air. We'd be glad to talk to you. But if you were to die tomorrow, where would you spend eternity? Have you ever wondered? If you were to die and go to heaven, or at least stand before the pearly gates, and St. Peter was to ask, well, why should you be allowed in? What would you respond? Do you really understand that there is a spiritual battle that's going on? And, of course, we're involved in this, and we're going to have to choose which side we're going to be on. And I hope that you will make your choice and make it wisely and not put it off. So, Sydney, then, of course, we want to mention to you that we hope you'll go to our website. We have a great deal of information on the supernatural there. We recommend very strongly my talk on the forbidden secret, which takes you into the supernatural. There's a syllabus that goes with that. The talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. There we actually present some of the publications that are put out by the people who worship the other god. And that other god is Lucifer. And once you understand that there are a lot of people who say they believe in God, they just don't tell you what god they believe in. So we suggest those two talks, Forbidden Secret, Planned Police State, the syllabuses that go with that. We have a four-tape set on the supernatural. We have a four-tape set on Satanism and deliverance. We have a four-tape set on satanic crimes. We have a book called Diary of a Devil Hunter, put out by a gentleman who was in the satanic movement, and eventually he came to know the Lord and then went around the country lecturing on satanic crimes. Of course, the Son of Sam killings was a satanic crime. The Manson was involved with the satanic organization, and same one fellow of the Son of Sam killings was involved in. But this is never going to be mentioned. It was the Church of the Final Judgment. And, of course, but this is totally suppressed by the controlled media. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. The Process Church of the Final Judgment. Pray for America. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. We'll be back for open lines during the next hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for this next hour, they better be your views as well, because my voice is not the strongest, and so I'm going to need your help. And if you have anything you'd like to talk about, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'd love to hear from you. What, until you call in, I'll tell you a little bit about the book I read on my vacation. We went back east to be with my granddaughter when she got married, and a beautiful wedding. But I took along with me the book by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who, if you recall, we interviewed Tuesday evening, just a week ago. Last Tuesday evening, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who is the commander of the coalition forces in Iraq from June of 2003 until June of 2004. And he had the coalition forces there. He was the man, of course, who was in charge of our forces at the time of the Abu Ghraib prison problem, the tragic events that occurred at Abu Ghraib. But what you must understand is that they were not certainly in any way associated with Ricardo Sanchez. He had no command function there at all. All of the military policemen that were involved were not answerable to him. They were answerable to the chain of command of the military police, which was independent of the chain of the commander of the commander of the coalition forces. Now, Ricardo Sanchez did do something, and after all, he was concerned about the safety of the people there in the both the prisoners and the guards at Abu Ghraib prison. And they were actually under siege from the surrounding area. So he did, of course, put a gentleman in there in military command so that they would defend that area. But that was the only thing he had done. He was concerned that because of the insurgency in the surrounding area, that the prison might itself be overrun. And so he actually put, I believe, a full colonel in there who was in charge. Well, we've got Brett calling in from Rapid City, South Dakota. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and let's go to Brett. Hi, Brett. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well, Dr. Stan. You sound a little rough tonight.
I do, and I appreciate you calling in.
Well, if you don't mind, I would like to share a very exciting event in the past week, though listeners may not think of it as very exciting. But this past Tuesday evening, my mother-in-law, who's a good godly woman, passed away. She had a massive heart attack in her home. But, Dr. Stan, I appreciate in the previous hour you telling the listeners, if you knew that your hour would come, are you ready to meet God? And the other evening, Tuesday evening, of course, my mother-in-law has been serving the Lord for a while. But in her garage, trying to retrieve a bicycle hanging from the garage ceiling, she had a massive heart attack. But she was able to call 911. And, of course, the paramedics came and got her. And one of the men, of course, it's a little town of 1,200 people. And in their little hospital, oftentimes the paramedics have to be of assistance in the emergency room. And one of the paramedics in the emergency room was there when my mother-in-law was going code red and said that while she was there, my mother-in-law was praying, said she was not in fear. She knew that she had had a massive heart attack, but said even while...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment, Pat. Go right ahead, Brent. Your mother-in-law was praying there in the emergency room, and I'm sure that probably what she did probably had some sort of an impact on the people who surrounded her, because, of course, I hope that they would have seen in her something different because she was a Christian.
The paramedics, the lady who was in the room isn't a Christian, does not profess any kind of religion whatsoever. But she told the pastor, my mother-in-law's pastor, that's down there. Really, she's a member of the church where I pastor here, but when she's back at her place, she attends this man's church, and she told him, she said, you came in and prayed with her three times, but he commented, he said, she didn't need me to pray with her. She was already in contact with God. But she said, what you don't know, Jeff, is that after you left, the doctors were working feverishly on her, and she was gasping for air. There were tears coming down her eyes, but there was pain. But said Jeff, while she was praying, said something strange began to feel funny in that room, and said it felt like somebody came in that room and said, Jeff, if I've ever seen anyone talk to God, she said it changed from talking to God, that it seemed like she began to talk with God. This paramedic told the pastor, said, Jeff, Christy would talk for a little bit and then listen, and would kind of smile and then respond like she was having a conversation. And she said, the only thing I can believe is that that lady in her passing moments, God or an angel or Christ himself, came to her room and led her, for only a few minutes later she passed from this life to the next. She said, I have never seen anything like this in all my life. You know, Dr. Stan, Christian people die well, and it's going to be worth it to be ready, whatever it takes.
Amen. And I believe that, and I believe that there is a supernatural element, and I believe sometimes that during life and sometimes as we enter death, why, we will have these supernatural manifestations and contact from the other dimension, because we know that the demonic forces are in contact. There's no reason why the angelic forces won't be as well. And I'm sure that it is a gratifying thing for you and those who love your mother-in-law to have heard this story.
You know, Dr. Stan, just a few years ago, 2001, my wife's father passed away.
Hold that thought, Brent. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Brent was just talking about when his mother-in-law, of course, passed away. Brent is a minister up there in Rapid City, South Dakota. In fact, my son and my grandson married the daughter of one of the ministers in Rapid City, South Dakota. There can't be too many of them up there if it's a small town. But anyway, Cindy Brent was talking about, of course, his mother's passing, and the people who witnessed it had a feeling that she was in communion with some other source, and then suddenly she was gone. But I heard a prayer. It was almost as if she would pray and then listen to somebody respond, and then, of course, speak again in prayer. Go right ahead. You were going to talk about your father, father-in-law?
Yes, my father-in-law passed away in 2001 at 50 years old. He was certainly a young man by most people's standards, and he got liver, cirrhosis of the liver, and it was simply because when he was a teenager, he had ulcerated colitis, and the medication they gave him killed his liver, I guess you would say. And he passed away, and up until his last few days, my father-in-law faced a terrific onslaught from the devil to try to undermine his faith. And yet he held steady through it all and won the victory, and he too crossed over victoriously. And then now my mother-in-law at 58, and that again seems really young. But you know, my wife and I remain, and my wife said the other day, she said, you know, it's really hard to feel sorrowful for Mom and for Dad. We know that they're in good hands, and we're simply just planning to meet them again.
And, of course, you know, this is what separates a Christian who faces death or a Christian who faces the loss of a loved one from somebody who doesn't know the Lord. Because then, of course, death is final. If you don't know the Lord, you don't believe in eternity, why, of course, they're gone. It's that old adage, you know, life is tough. You live 70 years, then you die, and that's it. Well, I don't believe that at all, nor do you. We believe that life is a challenge, it's a preparation for the next life. And, of course, we believe that there is an eternity and there is a reward, certainly for those who are true to the Lord. But when you see a Christian die, when you see a non-Christian die, it's the difference between darkness and light. And I really think that it's so vitally important for people to understand that life is a very transient affair. And the reason I mentioned that, the whole idea that, you know, we could die tomorrow. Certainly, we never know when we're going to die. But wouldn't it be a terrible, terrible shame to die and never to come into a personal relationship with the Lord? Mm. Anything else you want to say there, Brent?
Yes, Dr. Stan, thank you for listening and letting us share it. It's really a thrilling event to us, though we do have a measure of sadness. You said it right. There is a different sorrow. Paul didn't say we sorrow not. He said we sorrow not as others,
right,
which have no hope. We have a great hope, Dr. Stan. We're going to see him again one day by the grace and help of God.
God bless. Thanks very much, Jim. Brent, I'm sure you will.
Thanks to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Brent calling from Rapid City, South Dakota, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. The 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you'd like to talk about what I'm talking about, fine. If you want to talk about something else, that's what Open Lines is really all about. In fact, Joel Skousen, we hope, was going to be with us for 2 hours. And, of course, when Joel is on the line, as you've noted, those of you who listen to our afternoon program or my morning program with Joel, he's on every Thursday afternoon at either 3 or 4 o'clock. And then he's on Friday morning at 7 o'clock Pacific time. And, of course, you can hear him on AmericaNewsNet.com or on us and on RadioLiberty.com for the afternoon program. But, you know, Sidney, he just carries the whole program. In fact, I don't ordinarily even take callers because I want to hear what Joel has to say. So I cancel out the evening only to find out that he has a program with Jeff Rentz tonight at one time a month, and I certainly, well, I couldn't ask him to cancel that. So we're going to do open lines, and we hope that you'll give us a call. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So basically, of course, the book we're speaking of by General Ricardo Sanchez is called Wiser in Battle. It's about 450 pages. We will be carrying the book, and I think it's an important book. Wiser in Battle by General Sanchez. Now, why is it an important book? Well, of course, he gives you the whole history of his life. And coming from a poor family down in the Rio Grande, a Mexican family, and, of course, joining the ROTC and becoming an officer and then being discriminated against because he was Mexican. But he just hung in there. He played the game, the military game, did what was right, obeyed orders, and eventually he becomes a lieutenant general. And, of course, has a profound impact on the course of America's occupation of Iraq. And General Sanchez, of course, realizes, of course, that the Iraqis look upon us as occupiers of their country. We're not liberators. We may have liberated them from Saddam Hussein, but why did we just pick up and leave? Well, basically, that was what the initial plan was. And, of course, you'll remember, of course, we started the invasion sometime in March. And on the 1st of May, why, of course, President Bush lands in a plane on a carrier. And, of course, he gives you the impression he's flying the plane. He's not. He's just wearing the flight garb. But he gets out and then under this big banner that's up there on the carrier saying, mission accomplished, he announced that the war with Iraq was over. the war with Iraq was over, the killing was over, it was all over, and at that point, the military began to pull our troops out. Now, we had about 140,000, 160,000 troops. And the plan was to pull the American forces out to the point where we would have about 30,000 American troops. And then, of course, they were going to bring in the coalition troops. Now, the coalition troops did not go into there to fight at all. In fact, if there had been any fighting going in, we wouldn't have had any allies other than Great Britain and perhaps one other country, maybe Spain, I think it was. But it was all make-believe. The coalition force was there to give the American people the idea this was a coalition effort. These people did not come in almost until after the fighting had stopped and the president had announced that the war was over. And so suddenly General Sanchez is there and he takes command. And then, of course, over comes Paul Bremer. From the Council on Foreign Relations, Paul Bremer, certainly, in my estimation, part of the neoconservative movement. He is representing Henry Kissinger, who is one of the most evil men in the world. And what does he do? Paul Bremer, of course, announces to the military officers, I am in charge. Now, the military, of course, wanted to reconstitute the Iraqi army. After all, we'd promised that they would be maintained as a military unit if they did not fight against the United States. There were about 400,000 people in the Iraqi army, and instead of course, reconstituting them, what did Bremer do? Well, he said they will not get any compensation. They will not get the retirement pay. The generals, the officers, the people who put their whole life into serving in the military will not be compensated in any way. And then, of course, they simply refused to constitute the police force. They fired the people who were taking care of the electricity, fired the people who were taking care of sewage and water. They closed down all of the schools so the children couldn't get any education. They closed down many of the hospitals. They closed down the factories. Hundreds of thousands of people are out of work and they're angry. For no reason at all, the children can't even get an education. Why would you want to punish the children? But that's what Paul Bremer did. And Paul Bremer's not a foolish man. Certainly Ricardo Sanchez, and General Sanchez is very kind to Paul Bremer in his book. But I don't think so. I think it's unjustified. I think Paul Bremer knew exactly what he was doing. In fact, General Sanchez mentions, as he writes about what's going on, that none of this makes sense. And actually, he did something he'd probably never done before. He violated a direct order from Paul Bremer, and he told his commanders to go ahead and of course, to open the schools so the children could at least graduate. Why would you want to deprive the children of their right to graduate from school? And then, of course, they wanted to set up tribal councils. I mean, Iraq is controlled by tribal units. This is the way it's been for hundreds and hundreds of years. But Paul Bremer didn't want that. They wanted to bring democracy to a country that doesn't understand democracy, that doesn't want a democracy, that wants to live by its own traditions. But Paul Bremer and the leaders he represented had an entirely different agenda. And so they were forced to disband the local groups that could have been the cadre, the beginning of forming a truly representative government. They would have represented the people in those areas. But they were closed down, and any effort on the part of the people of Iraq to actually govern their own country were totally suppressed by Paul Bremer. We were going to bring them democracy. Do you remember the Iraqi woman holding up her finger with ink on it to show that she'd voted? That's not what they wanted. They wanted to get rid of the occupying forces. But, of course, we did everything we could. We actually allowed, of course, all the arms that were there, hundreds of arm dumps. And, of course, we had nobody to guard them. We didn't have any forces. They were pulling out all of the American forces just as rapid as they could. And had it not been for General Sanchez's being able to prevail on the commander of CENTCOM to stop this whole issue, there wouldn't have been any military there at all. Looting was going on. It was a totally, lawless society, all directly related to the Council on Foreign Relations. These people who wanted to create a problem. Why? Because they wanted to justify American being there. Not only that, but these people, in my estimation, are totally evil. Certainly we know that Henry Kissinger used to go to Marie Strong's place there in Colorado, La Boca Grande, the center for the Satanists of America and the world. Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. In the midst of all this discussion of saber-rattling around Iran, it's so strange because simultaneously, we have the whole Bush administration position falling apart regarding the Iraq invasion. We had, back in March, the Pentagon report titled The Saddam and Terrorism, Emerging Insights from Captured Iraqi Documents, based on 600,000 Iraqi documents that were captured after the invasion. And all of that points to falsehood on the part of the Bush administration. And then also we have, more recently, Scott McClellan's book, which seems to be igniting fires everywhere. And I believe it was Dennis Kucinich brought actual impeachment proceedings against Bush today. I heard a part of that. I have to get back to work on that and make sure it's even him. But it just seems so strange, like I said in the beginning of this call, that we have the supposed invasion coming up while the Iraq invasion is falling apart. Or at least, all the motivations are being exposed as fraudulent. So isn't one thing going to build on top of another if we go for Iran also, and then more fraudulence it will be exposed? And what's that going to do? Leave us in total chaos?
You're absolutely right,
Mike. Maybe what they want.
I think, Mike, well, you must understand that this is what they really want to do. They want to create the chaos. Our army is broken. And if you read my December 2007 newsletter, it was basically based upon a talk given by Ricardo Sanchez, I believe the 12th of October of last year. General Sanchez said, our army is broken. Our army is broken. And, of course, it's going to take us 10 years to get it fixed again. You must understand we do not have the military forces to deploy. General Sanchez talks about the fact that the reason that they have to keep sending our troops back again after being home for a few months is because there are not any forces to deploy. I mean, we have some forces in Korea, we have some forces in Germany, and we have some forces in Japan, but there were only about three readily prepared, fully trained units that could be sent into Iraq. And as you read this book, you suddenly realize how weak and impotent our military is. These people are setting out to destroy the United States military, and I'm firmly convinced of that. And then, of course, the attack on Iraq would be through our military, through our air force and through the Naval Air Force, which, of course, are indeed frightening. But, of course, as far as an active duty military, we have a demoralized military with poor leadership. In fact, as General Sanchez said, he was betrayed by the military. He spent his whole life dedicated to the military, and they betrayed him. And as he's going into retirement, he says, in the end, after 30-some years in the military, all you really have is your friends, your family, and your faith. And the army means nothing. Here's a man who dedicated his life to an army that betrayed him, and of course is betraying the men who are over there now. They're allowed to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but not to win. And that is the story that people do not understand. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And Mike is asking, why would we want to, of course, attack Iran, get into a war with Iran, when everything is going from bad to worse over there in Iraq? Oh, they tell us how much better things are. Why, this last week, things are better than they've been before. But, then, of course, 2 weeks from now, we'll probably have a series of new attacks and new bombings. And And we've lost so many men over there, totally unnecessarily. The surge is not going to solve the problem. What will solve the problem is getting the army of occupation out of Iraq. Now, they tell us that Al-Qaeda is just about, dissolved. But certainly, Al-Qaeda was never a force over there. It was never more than a few hundred, at the most, a few thousand people. Nobody ever wants to talk where the money comes from. But it comes probably in large part from Pakistan, our good friends in Pakistan, our good friends in Saudi Arabia, so it's good friends with the Bushes, and maybe some of the money coming from Jordan and from Syria. But the majority of it coming from Saudi Arabia. Most of the fighters there in Iraq, Al-Qaeda fighters, are Saudi Arabians. Why? Because Saudi Arabia has been funding, first, these schools, the Wahhabi schools, that actually have been indoctrinating people in this radical form of Islam. Fortunately, it's not the majority of the Iraqi, of the Muslim people, but it is those people who have been trained largely with American textbooks, and if you doubt that America provided textbooks to indoctrinate people in this radical form of Islam, give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a copy of the article from, of all places, the Washington Post, called The ABCs of Jihad. And, of course, we can get to the references in the book, The Terror Timeline, telling exactly the same story. The United States spent tens of millions of dollars, actually $51 million, to print up textbooks in Arabic to be used by young Arabic students to indoctrinate them in this radical form of Islam. Why would you do something that stupid unintentionally? Well, you would not do it unintentionally. You do it intentionally because you want to create the best enemy money could buy. If you want to have a war with the Muslim world, you've got to indoctrinate the Muslims with this radical form of Islam, get them to hate the Americans, just as you have to get the Americans to hate the Muslims. And there's so many books now being circulated among Christians about why we should hate the Muslims, how they want to kill us all, and we're going to have to kill them before they kill us, and how terribly they treat their women and their wives. And, well, at least they protect them from the moral degeneracy we have here in the United States. And I'm not supporting the way they treat women over there. But is it better to treat women the way we do and encourage them to be sexually promiscuous? And of course, 60 million Americans have a sexually transmitted viral disease. You won't find that in the Muslim countries. But anyway, everything's being done to get us to hate the Muslims and to get the Muslims to hate us. And when you understand that, so much of this makes sense, Mike, it doesn't make any sense going to war with Iran. And yet, apparently, that is exactly what is being planned. And I think it, of course, foreshadows a war with the Muslim world and perhaps with Russia and China as well. If you go back and you read Revelation 6:8 about the rider on the pale horse and a quarter of the people of the world would be exterminated by war, what better way than to have a nuclear war to exterminate a quarter of the population of the world? Okay, Mike, go ahead.
Well, it just seemed like there's even one, well, there are so many components to this whole thing, but another very large one is the World Trade Center, 9-1-1, and the fact that so many people, as time goes by, the years go by now, more and more people are becoming aware. At least they're having serious questions, and then as the information goes out further, it's starting to become more like a common knowledge that something really seriously was wrong with that, far beyond what they presented to us in the news that day, and during those days when it happened. So many unanswered questions, like the molten steel at the bottom. They actually showed us all that so many weeks later, and with no real explanation as to why it was there even.
Well, I think, Mike, I just finished another book, or at least part of it, called Who Were They? It was written by the medical examiner whose job it was to identify the remains that came in from DNA and to identify them. Well, first of all, there were 1,100 bodies that nothing has ever been recovered. 1,100 bodies. Were they crushed when the building pancaked, or were they vaporized when the building exploded is the question. But he talks about how in the basement of the Twin Towers, for 3 months after the collapse, were they burned with the intensity and the heat of a crematorium. How could you possibly... How could you possibly have steel burning for 3 months after the attack with the intensity of a crematorium? We'll be back in just a moment with Mike. Welcome your calls. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mike right now, and our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. It's open lines. If you have a subject you want to talk about, don't have to talk about what we're talking about at all. I would love to hear from you, but Mike, you go right ahead.
Yeah, well, picking up on what you were just saying, the news anchors back at the time of the collapse and following, the days and weeks afterwards, talked about the fires. The continued burning, under the ground, at the base of the buildings, and they talked about the intensity of and the heat and the way the fires couldn't be put out, and so many people had to think and realize that there just really isn't that much real fuel in those buildings to begin with. Some furniture, office paper, but most carpets and draperies are all rated for fire retardants. The fire department has codes that these buildings have to meet, and there's really so little that would actually ever burn in those buildings. One thing that we've all had to get educated in about those fires, though, that did continue burning and the intense heat was that in this case, steel itself was burning, and this was the ongoing reaction from the thermite and the thermate that were used in the destruction of the buildings. It sets up an ongoing reaction. It creates its own oxygen so it can keep on burning. Even underwater, you can read reports about the way that water was applied by the fire departments, etc., that just ran and ran and ran and ran, and the fires didn't go out. And I'm talking about things that were shown to us and told us back in September and October of 2001. You don't have to get this. It didn't originate years later on the Internet. There's no chance that any of this was made up by somebody sometime later on. But all these things were shown to us live at the time and told to us. So many times the news anchors, when they watched the buildings collapse, they talked about how this looks just like controlled demolitions like you see done to high-rise hotels in Las Vegas or wherever. And often they would say that once, and somebody else would step in and change the story, and the news anchor would be, I think, told how they should be talking about it, and not to mention this idea of the likeness of these collapses to the controlled demolitions in other cities and other times and places. So what I'm getting at is that more and more people are waking up to something really insidious and ugly and horrible going on at the top.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Mike. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mike from Santa Cruz. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And first, you can talk about any subjects you want to. Mike is talking about suddenly the molten steel that was at the base of the Twin Towers that burned for 3 months. Didn't matter how much water they put on it, it burned for 3 months. And, of course, in the book, Who Were They?, written by the pathologist, actually, who was in charge of identifying the DNA on the body's medical examiner, he talks about how the intensity of the fire in the basement of the buildings was for 3 months. With the intensity of a crematorium. So, I mean, this has got to be awfully hot. How do you get steel burning? How do you get molten steel? Well, you have to have some sort of a chemical, and this is what thermite or thermate will do. It'll provide its own oxygen so the steel can burn. But believe me, no other building has ever collapsed with the steel burning there for 3 months. And if you haven't ever heard these things, if you haven't heard about the fact that there were 1,100 bodies that were never identified, if you haven't heard that the 911 Commission, and you haven't read the book, of course, Without Precedent by Tom Keene and his right-hand man, Lee Hamilton, both from the Council on Foreign Relations, the chairman and co-chairman of the 911 commission, but there were 1,200 people who were called to testify. 1,100 of them, they sealed their testimony for 50 years because they don't want the American people to know about all the explosions in those buildings that were heard, and they did not dare let the American people know that they set those people up to die. How did they do it? I don't know. And I don't think anybody else does, because nobody's come forward. And do you think for 1 minute, if they do come forward, they would live very long? I know we interviewed a fellow named Leo Chavez, and all he did, of course, he'd been at the headquarters in Tampa, Florida, on the day of the attack, and he talked about, of course, the military exercises that morning of September 11th that feigned hijacked planes crashing into buildings. That and the fact that they had a stand-down order that Vice President Cheney was in charge of the Air Force that morning, which is why no planes rose to apprehend the hijackers. And after he had been on my program, he got so much flack that he would never answer his telephone again. He lost his job, came under tremendous attack, and I don't know what happened to Leo Chavez. We do have an article of I believe it's in the final program we did, 911, what really happened. You can actually read Leo Chavez's interview at the time, the things he wrote. But, of course, anybody who tried to come forward has had their life threatened. Everything's been done to silence them. So you're right, Mike. I think that more and more people are waking up. Something seriously happened.
What I'm getting at, though, is that so many people, yes, they are waking up, and where is that going to go? We could be headed towards out-and-out chaos, as we have there could be a general uprising building. And I wonder if these criminals at the top, these treasonous criminals, these insane treasonous criminals at the top, if they have even calculated this, that there would be a public uprising that would need to be quelled, and then they bring down martial laws and stick their put their prison camps into motion, and who knows what all they'll start to do.
Well, we do know, of course, that the Bush family has bought 200,000 acres in Paraguay. Now, why would anybody want to buy 200,000 acres of land in Paraguay? All they get down there, big snakes and spiders, or maybe they know what's going to happen in America, and they're looking for some place to run.
Well, more and more people are waking up to just what the Bush family is all about, and they darn well better get out of the country. So,
Anyway, anything else you want to say before we let you go?
So many things. You probably have some callers waiting.
Anyway, it's always good to hear you, Mike.
Yeah.
You can call back later if you want to. Let's go to Gary calling from Santa Cruz, and again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
Good evening. I found some interesting stuff about this Scott McQuillan
affair. Right.
And the publisher that co-wrote the book with him, the book is called What Happened, and his name is Peter Osnos, and he's a publisher of an outfit called Public Affairs. And Peter Osnos was the assistant to I.F. Stone, who was identified as a Soviet spy, I think, in the Venona Papers. And, of course, his parents came from Russia, and according to the Venona Papers, his KGB name was Blin, B-L-I-N. And Peter Osnos' biography, it mentions that he's the senior fellow for media at the Century Foundation. And the Century Foundation is actually the old 20th Century Fund. They changed the name. The 20th Century Fund, according to Dan Smoot in his 1958 book, which is a half a century ago, he mentions that there are 20 trustees and that 13 are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. That was in 1958. So I look up, the foundation was formed in 1919, and it was basically designed to control the media. Its founder was Edward A. Fellini, he was in touch personally with both Woodrow Wilson and Vladimir Lenin. according to the biography.
Okay, enough of Gary. I've read a lot of this, and certainly it's been put out by Newsmax, and Cliff Kincaid wrote an article like this, and pointing out, of course, that Scott McClellan's book, was published by people from the radical left. But does that in any way alter what he said? He said basically that the Bush organization, President Bush, used propaganda. The people surrounded, President Bush used propaganda to sell us on the idea of going to war. It doesn't matter that the people who published the book are radical leftists. You're certainly not going to get that sort of a book published by HarperCollins or by the other respectable publications controlled by the CFR. The question is not, who published the book, but is McClellan right that President Bush intentionally misled the American people and, of course, used propaganda to get us into a war that's resulted in the murder of a million people?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, but I think what we're seeing here is that basically intelligence agents tripping all around themselves, and we're looking at the scenery and surrounding part, and again, in the next sentence, it turns out the 20th Century Fund was set up by Fellini, who was a friend, of Lenin, and he was also working with, he worked together with Pierre Jay, who was Skull and Bones and the first chairman of the New York Federal Reserve in 1913.
Well, what you're basically saying, Gary, is that the communist movement was funded by the American establishment, which is absolutely true.
Right, exactly. Communism is not the people overthrowing the banking establishment. Communism is the banking establishment enslaving the people.
Yeah, that's a beautiful line and absolutely correct. Would you mind repeating that?
That is, communism is not the people overthrowing the banking establishment, but it's the banking establishment enslaving the people.
Now, of course, what people have to understand is that communism has been used. It was created as an enemy, the best enemy money could buy. Why? Because you needed, you can't have a fencing match unless you've got somebody to fence with. And that's what it's all about. Oh, we fought a lot of wars with communism in China, in Korea, and in Vietnam, but we never tried to win the battles. We just sent our men in to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but never win the wars. They were both no-win wars. It's all as phony as a $3 bill, and you're absolutely right, Gary.
Well, and the other thing that's really interesting about this publisher is he's published books for, for instance, John Kerry, George Soros, Putin, and he used to be in charge of Random House, and back in Random House days, he published books for Paul Volcker, he published books for Rhodes Scholar Clinton, and he's published books for Yeltsin. So he is at the pinnacle doing the both sides, and the same is true. You're looking at, I.F. Stone and Alger Hiss and some of these people that were, like Alger Hiss was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I think it's at apex where they got a foot in both camps. It really shows clearly that communism doesn't come from Moscow or Peking. It comes from London, New Haven, and New York City.
Amen to that.
And again, he's surrounded by these people like, the Volkers and all of those people. Now, get this, and this is from Cliff Kincaid, and he mentions that in all of his books, he now dedicates them to three different people. One, I.F. Stone, who's been identified as a Soviet, with the New York mayor, Robert Bernstein's, whose parents were communist, and Benjamin C. Bradley. Now, Benjamin C. Bradley was in the Office of Naval Intelligence and the U.S. Information Educational Exchange, which included the Voice of America. Ben Bradley prepared information for the CIA for films, magazines, research papers and speeches. Bradley was part, he's a natural for being assigned to Operation Mockingbird because, he ended up with the Washington Post and these other places.
Well, there's no question at all, of course, that the media is controlled. There's no question at all that, of course, the people who published Scott McClellan's book are radical leftists.
I'm looking at a picture right now, Stan, and I've got a picture of him sitting with his wife, Annette Pinchett Bradley. Her sister, Mary Pinchett, married Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer was in charge of the CIA Operation Mockingbird. He's sitting there with Kennedy, Jacqueline, and JFK. The program was designed, Operation Mockingbird, for the people that are listening, was designed to play CIA agents into the media to push the New World Order policies and whatever political moves they were working.
Well, of course, they control both the right, the left, the conservative, the liberal, the Republicans, the Democrats. But, you know, I think it's so interesting, of course, that they published Scott McClellan's book. And it's getting a tremendous play. And basically, what he said, I believe, is absolutely true.
Well, get this to his father.
Gary, let me finish.
Sure.
That basically, Scott McClellan's book told the truth. That they did use propaganda to sell the war to the American people.
Oh,
they
absolutely
lied to the American people. The question is, why is the establishment allowing this to come out today? Now, basically what you're doing is saying, and I like Cliff Kincaid, is consider him a friend, but friends can disagree. And I think that Cliff is taking the official party line. Scott McClellan's a terrible guy, you know, because he's defamed our courageous president. Then you've got the people on the left who are saying Scott McClellan's telling the truth. And Sidney, what they're doing is, of course, creating this tremendous controversy over a book. And they're trying to discredit this so that people really don't know what to believe. See, since it's published by a pro-communist organization, maybe we should believe what McClellan is saying. Well, we should believe what he's saying, because it's true. I don't care if Lenin has come to back to life to say, you know, if he said it, doesn't mean it's necessarily false. In fact,
you're absolutely right. This is part of the Hegelian move, and that's
absolutely
what we see here. And in fact, Cliff Kincaid from Accuracy in Media was founded by Reed Irvine, who was Marine Intelligence, a Fulbright scholar, and worked for a decade or so for the Federal Reserve. And they've never mentioned, with the exception of Cliff Kincaid, they've never mentioned the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilat, and Bilderbergers. I think Cliff stands head and shoulders above that outfit, and it was loaded with people from the State Department and anyway, I won't go through all of that stuff, but I think they were part of Operation Mockingbird at the very beginning. They don't, I don't know how tight some of those controls are.
Okay, I agree with you. I accept everything you said as being absolutely valid. And I think what they're doing is getting us arguing back and forth, you know. Shouldn't we believe Scott McClellan? Look at those terrible people, you know, the radical leftists pushing that the Communist Party line. Because the Communist Party line doesn't mean it isn't true. So basically, of course, I think that we're going to see George Bush set up, and I believe this has been the plan all along, to make him out the worst president we've ever had. Now, I'm not saying he's not the worst president we've ever had, but certainly what they want to do is getting arguing on all the wrong issues.
Right, this was designed to control the news cycle for this period. Absolutely true.
But I think the big concern is not did George Bush lie, because he did lie. And he knew, or he should have known, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. He simply is a script reader. He says what he's supposed to say. And whether he knew he was lying or not, I don't know. But I do know what he said was frankly not true. And what he says, we do not torture people. And then, of course, he threatens to veto a legislation that says we should not be torturing people. Why, of course, I don't think he's being entirely honest with the American people. So,
yes, the other interesting side on this is that the wife of Bradley and, of course, the wife of Mayor Cord, the Pinchots, their uncle was Gifford Pinchot, and he was the one that created the parks and sanctuaries from the very beginning, early in the century, setting up the so-called land trust and wildlands type of thing, something that the Skull and Bones used with their land-grant colleges and used all the land for themselves. But this is very fascinating. This is all super inside intelligence people that are working cutouts for one aspect of the intelligence agency or another.
Well, I think that what we have to, of course, is not get bound down in what they want us to. In other words, what they want to do is keep idle minds busy. And we'll argue back and forth whether Scott McClellan's a good guy or bad guy, whether Chris and his publishers are good guys or bad guys. At the same time that they're manipulating us to do a war, expanding the war with Iran. And that is the thing. What they want to do is get us thinking about non-important things, Paris Hilton, you know, Britney Spears and Scott McClellan and his publisher, rather than the fact that we may very well be facing an expansion of the war with Iran. When it's coming, I don't know, but I do believe it's coming.
Another fascinating place for people to look, and I think there's room for a lot of research on it, is the 10 Schools organization. Virtually all the people from the Skull and Bones, Scroll and Key, et cetera, are fished out of this 10 Schools organization out of the New England area. And it's very fascinating to go through the 10 schools and look who their famous graduates are. And you just go, it's all the key people that you're mentioning this evening or any other night of the week. Very fascinating pool of talent that they draw from.
Well, of course, they're very, very, basically, they're very, very clever. They are an elitist organization. They try to recruit intelligent, sophisticated people into their organization and then indoctrinate them with the idea, wouldn't it be wonderful to create this one world government, to do away, of course, with war, to bring prosperity to people in third world countries, to improve the lot of people throughout the world, to do away with disease. And a lot of idealistic people get into this without realizing that behind this are powerful spiritual forces that want to kill off most of the people in the world, of course, want to engender more wars and disease and famine and certainly there's going to be a tremendous hunger here. There's going to be tremendous hunger. Hold on. Gary, go right ahead.
Yes, I think one of the interesting things, I read a biography of William Bennett, the guy that wrote the Book of Virtues, etc., and he was talking about when he was very young, he asked William Sloan Coffin what he should do. And so William Sloan Coffin was Skull and Bones. And we also read in a book about William F. Buckley that he says that he wished he had lived his life as a communist. So it's like they can kind of select the role they want to play. They're players on a bigger stage.
I think you're absolutely right. Incidentally, of course, William Bennett was a member of the Project for the New American Century. He was one of the neoconservatives, and he was selected to lead the Catholics, just as Gary Bauer was selected to lead the Protestants. Now, if anybody would like to verify what I've said, you can go up onto the Internet and look up newamericancentury.org, newamericancentury.org. It is the website that was set up by the Project for the New American Century, and lo and behold, you find out that they've taken the website down. But if you were to have gone into that, into their publication in the year 1997, you would find out that they laid out their statement of principles of this neocon organization, neoconservative organization, under the back were 27 names, among them William Bennett, the Book of Virtues gentleman you're talking about. People must understand, if you want to get that, the entire website we downloaded because we knew they were going to pull it. We have it in our syllabus entitled Iraq, the Untold Story, going into the background of course, the fact that the war with Iraq was all contrived by this group of neoconservatives who were followers of Plato and Machiavelli and, of course, of Leo Strauss and Michael Ledeen.
Two things I recently found on the Internet, which is absolutely wonderful, but I encourage people to get the hard copy always. But they have Tragedy and Hope in its entirety, and they also have Philip Drew Administrator, which is available for people that want to talk about it. And of course, Colonel House is related, or Karen House, the wife of the owner of the Wall Street Journal, comes from that same family.
We used to. The Wall Street Journal was purchased by
Murdoch, I believe, now, yes.
Recently. But anyway, of course, I suggest you follow through on these things. We do carry Tragedy and Hope. We do carry the Philip Drew Administrator available through Radio Liberty. But if you want to get them on the Internet, they're there. I prefer having the book there.
Absolutely.
It's a lot cheaper than trying to print that thing at the expense. Hey, hold on for just a moment, Gary. Well, this is Dr. Stan. The hour has flown by. Gary, you have a parting thought before we let you go?
That's fine, although they should get the book from you. I believe it was going for about $200 when it was very hard to get. So
well, it's nowhere near that.
For a bargain.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
And that's certainly the book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, written by Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor. It's an important book. Why is it important? Because he talks about the secret society, or at least one of the secret societies that controls America. Here's the leading historian of the last century writing about a secret society. Why, my goodness, everybody knows there's no conspiracy. Rush Limbaugh will tell you there's no conspiracy. Sean Hannity will tell you there's no conspiracy. George Best will tell you there's no conspiracy, but there really is, and Professor Quigley writes all about it. His book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, was so important that someone came in and bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and then destroyed the plates to the first half of the book so it couldn't be republished. And if that story sounds amazing, we offer, along with the Tragedy and Hope special, a copy of the interview we have with Professor Quigley, where he tells about how his book was actively suppressed. All of these available by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. You need to understand there really are secret societies. Now, what Professor Quigley missed is the fact that there was a powerful spiritual force behind this secret society that he wrote about. This secret society that began in 1891, founded by Cecil Rhodes, by Lord Milner, by William Stead, who was a theosophist and involved in spiritualism, and certainly by a man named Lord Escher, or his name was Brett. He became Lord Escher, and he was the personal advisor to the King of England for a period of 25 years, King or Queen of England, whoever was there. He was the man who controlled the British royalty. And, of course, during that time, they led England into the Boer War and then the First World War and set up the preparations for the Second World War. The Second World War was totally contrived. Adolf Hitler was financed by Great Britain and the United States. If you have not yet read Tragedy and Hope, they'll tell you how, of course, it was the English who were encouraging Adolf Hitler at every turn, but they couldn't let the English people know that. And, of course, you need the book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler to understand how it was American corporations that funded Adolf Hitler and kept him in power. Well, and even, of course, traded with him not only before the Second World War, but during the Second World War, when the war materials being produced by American corporations were used to kill American boys. And just as the many of the explosive devices being used in Iraq today, the timing, the explosive trigger, just happened to be made in the United States and accidentally sent to Yemen, and then accidentally ended up in the hands of the Iraqi terrorists. How could that have happened? Aw, shucks, we have no idea. Just like not too long ago, we sent the triggers for nuclear weapons just accidentally to Taiwan. And, of course, recently, within the last week, why two Air Force generals have been relieved of command for making that terrible mistake. But did they really make the mistake, or are they being used as scapegoats in the way that General Ricardo Sanchez was used as a scapegoat for the torture that was advocated by the Pentagon to be used on helpless and often innocent people? And I'd like you to think about their screams. Innocent people being tortured by American soldiers under orders from the Pentagon. Because, of course, ladies and gentlemen, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And if you're not getting it educated and then helping us get the information out, then you become part of the problem. And if you don't have to face the music in this life, you will in the next life. Because I believe God expects all of us to be involved in this spiritual battle which is currently being fought for the souls of men, the survival of Western civilization. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the CD that goes with it. You need to get our talk, The Forbidden Secret, and the syllabus. Planned Police State, and the syllabus. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.